We're gonna take a trip right now. Like we always do about this time.
This is a journey into sound. Break it
down. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to Cultural Manifesto. On this week's show, we'll celebrate Pride by exploring the history of Labyrinth, a feminist lesbian bar that operated near downtown Indianapolis from 1978 to 1984. We'll listen back to my 2021 interview with the owner and founder of Labyrinth, Mary Byrne. And I'll share excerpts from my 2021 interview with Lee Weaver, an Indianapolis musician who performed at Labyrinth. Mary Byrne is best known for her work as an activist in the LGBTQ+ community. But Mary also has a significant history in Indiana music. During the 1980s and 90s, Mary was the director of the National Women's Music Festival in Bloomington, Indiana. And from 1978 to 1984, Mary was the owner of Labyrinth, a feminist lesbian nightclub and music venue that was located in the Lockerbie neighborhood of Indianapolis. Labyrinth was located at 631 East Michigan Street. Today, the building sits empty, with for sale signs plastered across the windows. But during the late 70s and early 80s, this humble neighborhood bar was buzzing with activity. In addition to providing a safe space for lesbian and feminist Hoosiers, Labyrinth featured live music from stars of the women's music scene, including the singer-songwriter Holly Near and the 70s rock legend June Millington, known for her work with the band Fanny. I discussed all of this and more with Mary Byrne. Let's join our conversation. And you came in 1974 to Indianapolis, correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Describe to me sort of the culture of Indianapolis at that time, kind of what your impressions were.
I would say the culture was dead. Nobody went downtown. It wasn't that it was not safe. It was just that nothing was there.
And it wasn't too long after you arrived here that you opened Labyrinth, the bar you managed for several years. I think it was 78 that you opened Labyrinth.
Yeah.
What prompted you to start thinking about opening a nightclub? Is that something you'd ever imagine doing?
No. I just started meeting all of these women and feminists, and there was only this dark, dungy place down on South Street called Darlow's, and I just felt like women needed a place to go that reflected positive and good vibes and things like that. So that I kind of started learning. I got a job at Waffle House and started learning how to do food and, you know, cost of sales and that sort of thing. And then I went to a bartending school, got a job as a bartender for a while. I knew exactly where I wanted it located and watched the papers, and bingo, there it was. It was a country music tavern that I tried to run over the winter. I was not a bar person, and I thought that, of course, winters would be the slow time during a bar season. And, you know, no, it's not. Summer is slow because you've got millions of other things to do. So I kept it as a country music tavern through, the end of December, so like maybe 2 months. And then I realized that my staff was ripping me off. And so I just closed it and cleaned it and renovated it and got the word out. And we opened in March. And on our opening night, one of my friends came to me and said, I think we have problems in the parking lot. And I went out, and there were 28 slashed tires on 24 cars. So I had to come back into this party and say, hey, we got to stop. Everybody has to help everybody else change tires. Come back in, and we'll have a party.
I understand that created problems for you, trying to protect the clientele that was patronizing Labrys from some of these angry or hateful characters who used to come to this bar and start trouble. I heard you employed a few different tactics. You had a membership card
that women would
receive that were regulars. And you also would sometimes institute an absurdly high door fee to get in if you were trying to kind of weed people out. Yeah, tell me about some of the things you did to kind of, like I said, protect your clientele. And
well, when you first walked in the door, I built this L-shaped hallway that you came down, and there was a window and a door. And that door into the bar was always locked coming in, and it was always unlocked going out. So it was not a safety problem. But we got a chance to see who was coming in the bar. And at that point, at the very beginning, we were trying to figure out a way that we could kind of prioritize women and weed out people that were going to be there that could cause trouble. And after a while, well, the membership thing wasn't really, I found out that it wasn't really legal or kosher, so we didn't do that anymore. And neither really was the door charge, but we did do that. But then after a while, it just was a matter of that we saw, a guy and a woman come in, and we were just very frank. It says, this is a women's bar, and if everybody acts appropriately, please come in. So because there was also a thing that I was dealing with at the time, that the word feminism and feminist was a really was derogatory almost. It was not a good thing. And there was another women's bar in town, and they, maybe it was because I was infringing on some of their clientele, which wouldn't really be the case, but they kind of circulated it that we hated men. You know, that's always the thing. You can't be pro-women unless you hate men, and that was not the case at all. So we did have to deal with kind of internal gay politics things. Because the other point is, it was very definitely a feminist bar. Now, granted, I'd say substantial number of people, women that came down, were lesbian, but not all. And I'd say almost half of my investors were not lesbian. So it was very much a feminist bar, and then that's why we did the music there.
And Mary, quickly, you referred to the connotations or the response to the word feminism at this time as being very negative. And I wanted to get, better understand why that might be. Was it because people associated it with a radical political point of view, or it was just something that people were uncomfortable with? Why did this word feminism have such a strongly negative view in society at that time?
Well, I would say it's the same reason that it has a bad connotation now. I mean, like if somebody's sitting in my face and they say, they ask me, you know, are you a feminist? I say back to them, well, what do you mean by that word? Because it's never, their definition of the word is never the same as mine. And so I think that the movement at that point in time didn't do a very good job of defining that word or that movement for people. Kind of an inclusiveness and opportunities for everyone across the board. And I also think that people thought that feminism was only something that was going to affect women. And, you know, it has great amount of effects on men, too. I mean, can't help but take some of that pressure off of men when women can step up in that relationship and pull in some money or, you know, so an equalitarian relationship helps both people.
You said that your definition of feminism differs from the Joe public on the streets definition. How do you define feminism? What is your definition of it?
Just that there's opportunity for all. Equal opportunity, a more equalitarian government, relationships, workplace, anything like that is just more fair and equal to everyone, and not just women, men. You know, so feminism in the workplace or in relationship to sex, race, gender, religion, it's just all equal, and you look at individuals.
Every woman, whoever loved a woman, you ought to stand up and call out her name.
That was Holly Near with Every Woman. Holly Near was one of the many significant musicians who performed at Labyrinth, a feminist lesbian bar that operated in Indianapolis from 1978 to 1984. This week on Cultural Manifesto, we're celebrating Pride Month by looking back at the history of Labyrinth. Let's return to my conversation with the club's founder and owner, Mary Byrne. And Mary, getting back to Labyrinth, the women's club you opened in the Lockerbie neighborhood in the late 1970s, you eventually started featuring music there. And you featured very prominent musicians through the years at this club. You talked about your preparation for owning a business. You went to bartending school. You learned how to prepare food and manage a bar. At that point, were you thinking about featuring music at the bar, or did that just come as you kind of went along with the experience of managing it? You never set out to make it a music venue, right?
No, I don't think I set out to make it a music venue. But right around that time, late 70s, is when the National Women's Music Festival was starting over in Champaign. We had gone to the Michigan Women's Music Festival maybe a year or two. And so my eyes were opening to what was to be called women's music, or how music performed by, written by women could have such a positive effect on women's lives. And so it just made sense. And it was also a great way to get a crowd in. I had to figure out ways of making money in a variety of different ways, because I wasn't going to do it like a normal bar.
And featuring music was one of the things featuring, you tried?
Yeah, right, yeah. Right, because you sold tickets, and so hopefully, you know, there was some money left over for the bar. But then I had a whole group of women who came down, and after the music, then they were there. I mean, so.
Yeah, and, you know, as I mentioned to you earlier, you know, when I look at your life and everything you've accomplished, to me, I see music as having a big place in all that. And I think your achievements within the field of music in Indiana are really extraordinary. But I'm curious, you know, how you see that aspect of your work. And was that something that you really had much of an interest in prior to opening Labyrinth? Were you a big music fan? Were you really tuned in to what was happening in music, going to concerts? Was this an area you ever kind of expected or wanted to get into prior to this?
No. Yeah. No, but the point was community and community building. And this music and going to these festivals, listening to this music, was an incredible community building thing. I produced 3 or 4 concerts before I opened the bar, just to get a sense of whether or not women would come and support something like that. And they were very popular, and it got women to because I would talk about opening the bar at these concerts. And the last one was a Holly Near concert that we had out at Brebeuf. And I just told them, okay, got the bar. I've been talking about this. You've been asking what you can do to help. So now I need your help.
And to my knowledge, to my understanding of the development of the music scene here in Indianapolis. This was an untapped market, right? The women's music market. You weren't competing with other clubs.
Correct.
There was no one else presenting this type of entertainment on a regular basis.
No. At the time, you know, you had disco, and nothing bad about disco, but that was kind of the gay bar scene. And so really live music wasn't really part of that scene at all. Maybe a few comedians at Talbot Street, but most of that entertainment was drag shows. Famous Door was open at that time. And these were women who would not have come out to a bar normally. So, and during the week, you know, we would have euchre tournaments or pool tournaments it was, again, very community building.
Yeah, you mentioned presenting Holly Near at Rebuff, did you say?
Yes.
And, you know, Holly Near is an iconic figure in women's music. And I understand, is this correct, that she also performed at Labyrinth too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's incredible. I mean, is a major... internationally touring artists that you featured in this, you know, small little nightclub. I'm curious about some of the other performers that you featured over the years at Labyrinth. Do things stand out in your mind, certain performers?
Chris Williamson was, at the time, the biggie. Margie Adam, Teresa Troll, June and Jean Millington had a group called Fanny at the time. Or before, right before then. And they went on tour. Oh, gosh, that was a wonderful concert. They went on tour with Linda Tillery and Mary Watkins. And Robin Flower was bluegrass, probably top of bluegrass. We just had all kinds. There was a jazz group called Alive that was spectacular. I bet they came to the bar maybe 5 or 6 times. And then we also had local people. The person that was Marg Herder had a group called Soft Sound.
Software. Yeah,
Software.
Incredible group, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And Barbell played a lot, and there was a group called La Femme. So there was a lot of local stuff happening. We would have benefits for different organizations and so local people would play those. And Nan Brooks had a theater company called Womankind, Womanshine. Boy, I'm going back here. But there's just a little bit of everything. And, but that's also women's music. It's just very, very broad as far as the genre of music.
And you closed the club around 1983, 82?
83, 84.
Okay.
Maybe.
And you were tired of running a nightclub? Well, the business was dwindling? What was happening?
Yes. Yeah. The business was dwindling. By that time, I had started producing the National Women's Music Festival, and it was probably my energy level waning also. You know, running your own business just takes so much. And I think that there's kind of a circular pattern with a bar or restaurant or whatever. And it was just time to let it go. And but we had a big party, a celebration. I mean, it was not, it was too bad. I really wished that I had been able to find somebody that would buy it and run it. It's Labyrinth, because I would like to have gone there. I couldn't.
I'm curious if you miss being involved in the music scene. Have you missed that presence in the music scene through the years?
There is absolutely nothing as thrilling as planning a concert. You know, you go from the big picture, getting the act, just all the details of the marketing, the sound, the house manager, you get all this stuff. You get on stage, you watch the sound check. You've got a great engineer out there. You're backstage. You know that you've got a nice crowd. And there's just absolutely nothing like that rush to say, welcome, glad you came to the concert, and here we have, a great show for you. So it gives me goosebumps to think about it. It's just really fun. It was incredibly fun.
And Mary, my final question to you is, I'm curious how you assess your impact on music in Indiana and in Indianapolis. To me, you had a huge impact, and it's really hard to even kind of wrap my head around all the things you were doing and things you were involved in. Not only did you create a platform for women's music here in the state, you created a safe space for openly gay women performers to, share their art with people here, something that I don't know how tangible that was for these performers prior to some of the stages you created. Looking back on this, how do you assess your impact in the music scene here in Indiana?
Well, I think that the music had a mammoth impact on both individual women. I mean, that's why I got into it. I started hearing this music, and it spoke to me. It was the thing that started healing, all the garbage I'd heard about myself since I was young, that I didn't fit in, that I wasn't worth enough, that I was not beautiful, that I was, you heard all this stuff. And here is this music that it just makes you whole. It starts that healing thing. And I think that music touched every individual woman's life. So in one way, that just, that all of those people got to experience that. And then the idea that you could form a community around that music and again, reinforce that positiveness, weekly, by getting together with your friends or whatever. I think it's had a profound influence on me and my life, and I know on other women.
And Mary, in the short time that you're here with me this evening, there's no way we can get into all the different things you've done in your life, especially your work as an activist, which is really interesting, and that's a book on its own, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But fortunately, if our listeners do want to learn more about your life and work, there are a lot of places here in Indiana where they can do that. The Indiana Historical Society has an oral history you recorded. They have a huge collection of artifacts and papers from your time running Labbers, the National Women's Music Festival, your work as an activist, and other things you were involved in. You told me that you donated a collection of books, over 2,000 books, to Central Library in downtown Indianapolis. And I think there's other things in the works. If folks want to learn more about you, there's plenty of places here they can do that, right?
Yeah.
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 And I can't thank you enough for taking time to be
here.
Any final thoughts you want to share?
Well, I have to say it back to you. I'm just blown away by what you know coming into this interview. You came to this interview as an equal partner in this interview. So I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mary. It's an honor to meet you and hear
Thanks,
more
Kyle.
About this work. Appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We've been listening back to my 2021 conversation with Mary Byrne, the owner and founder of Labyrinth, a feminist lesbian bar that operated in Indianapolis from 1978 to 1984. Up next, we'll hear from Lee Weaver, an Indianapolis musician who performed at Labyrinth during the early 1980s. But first, let's hear music from Chris Williamson, one of the many stars of women's music that Mary Byrne brought to Indiana. This is Shine On, Straight Arrow. Cultural Manifesto will return after this short break. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to a special Pride Month edition of Cultural Manifesto. We're celebrating the legacy of Labyrinth, a feminist lesbian bar that opened near downtown Indianapolis in 1978. We just heard my 2021 interview with the club's founder and owner, Mary Byrne. In just a moment, we'll listen back to my conversation with Lee Weaver, an Indianapolis musician who performed at Labyrinth. Today, Lee is a non-binary trans person. Lee uses they and them pronouns. But during the early 1980s, Lee was a lesbian woman known as Marg Herter. I've featured Lee's music many times on Cultural Manifesto, particularly their work with the incredible Indianapolis synth rock band Software. Up next, I want to share a rare, unreleased recording of Marg Herter performing live at Labyrinth in 1981. This is Dreamer Awake.
Dreamer took an all the look to check the time. Well, it's a wonder that she looked into my eyes. Well, welcome, dreamer, I'm the sage. It took you long enough to find the only way. Still, you're welcome just the same.
That was Dreamer Awake by Marg Herter, recorded live at Labyrinth in 1981. Today, Marg Herter is known as Lee Weaver, a non-binary trans person. I spoke with Lee Weaver in 2021. We discussed their early performances at Labyrinth and their work with the Indianapolis synth rock band Software. Let's join our conversation. Yeah, I'm curious about the physical spaces in Indianapolis that existed at that time that your group was able to kind of thrive in. You know, you mentioned earlier that your music was sold at Dreams and Swords, feminist bookstore. There was also a club you played in, which has most recently been, I think, Lockerbie Pub.
Labyrinth.
Was a feminist nightclub. Tell me about the spaces that, the physical spaces that Software kind of existed in here in Indianapolis. You also played at the National Women's Music Festival in Bloomington.
We did.
Yeah, tell me about those spaces at that time.
So when I started playing music out before we formed Software, played at Labyrinth several times. Mary Byrne owned that club, and it was the spot for music, national women's music people, which for those that don't know, women's music is like code word for lesbian music at the time. So when there was a whole national circuit, national performers, and the big gatherings of lesbians were music festivals. So there was the Michigan Women's Music Festival, which is kind of famous. Everybody would go to that, and the main thing of course, there were workshops on all kinds of different topics happening, and there was a, you know, spiritual expression that was unique to lesbian feminism called Dianic Wicca, kind of the state religion of the lesbian feminists. But the whole thing was about music. Who was, you know, there were stages going all the different times, and so Labyrinth was one of those venues across the country. Mary was a promoter who would bring in the national, more national known musicians. They'd play there. Local people like me would play there. Women's music at the time was Holly Near and some of these people, very folk oriented. sometimes instrumentals, a little bit of jazz, but not rock. Rock was bad. Rock was boys. You know, no, we don't want rock. So when we came into the National Women's Music Festival, there were people that were like, they just didn't think we should be there.
Well, Lee, I do want to jump into talking about software, but first I want to learn more about the concept of the band, because mm-hmm. this was an electronic music project, right? An electronic right. rock band, let's say. Synth rock, as it would be called later. When did you first get a synthesizer?
I'm pretty sure it was before software started. And I just thought they were cool. So I got a Juno 6, which was a slimmed down version of the Jupiter 8, or it was a Roland machine, Jupiter 8 or the later. The Jupiter 6 didn't come out till later, but this Juno 6 is just a little, you know, six voice polyphonic thing. But oh my God, I could just sit there and play with this thing for hours and hours and hours. It was just unlimited sonic possibilities. So
coming together as software, you'd mentioned you'd met Kara and Diane at college
we all kind of knew each other. And then Diane and I were together when we started the band.
Did you come into this knowing you wanted to start a synthesizer-based group, or what was sort of the concept coming in?
Well, I think the concept coming in was just that we were going to try to play music that was unusual and, you know, that worked to our skills, right? The main thing was that we wanted to play original music. We thought it was good, and we wanted to do it. And we also – there hadn't been an all-female – there was an all-female band, La Femme, I think was her name.
Kara was in that group,
Kara was
right?
in it,
yeah,
right.
More folk group, right?
Yeah, and that was more along the lines of, you know, what women were doing in music then. But we just wanted to be rock. And, you know, I played electric guitar and had a Les Paul, and Kara had a – I don't remember what she was playing at the time. I think a really wonderful playing Guild electric guitar. And we just wanted to do that. We're all kind of butch lesbians, right? So we want to be like the guys, you know, and have a regular band, not a girl band. We wanted to be an excellent regular band.
The music I've heard from software encompasses a lot of different sounds. There mm-hmm. is that progressive side of your musical taste. There also is, though, a sort of punk, post-punk, new wave aspect to the group. Describe to me all the different musical elements that were coming together in this band.
Well, you know, like anything else, we were listening, right? We were listening to what was going on. We weren't even so much listening to punk, but there was – punk kind of came out of something that was happening then, and I don't even know that it's ever really been described. But we had an idea of what – we just wanted to be edgy, wanted to be edgier than any women's music we'd ever heard or any music we'd ever heard women making. I mean, even when the Go-Go's came out, we were like, oh, come on, there's more of that, you know? Although I have great respect – you know, for their songwriting and for what they were able to do at the time. It's amazing. But it wasn't the sound we wanted. We wanted what felt like a serious sound to us.
And from the songs I've heard, it sounds like you were one of the primary vocalists and one of the primary songwriters. Describe to me kind of who was singing, who was writing the music.
Diane would write every now and then. So I think I think one of the best songs that we have is Plastic World. That's one of hers.
Yeah, I love that song. Yeah.
I do too. And just, you know, it kind of gives you the idea of what we were about at the time. So you have the backing track in 5/4, right? And then the vocals going across the top in 4/4. I mean, that was the kind of thing we just loved, you know?
I wanted to ask you about that song, Plastic World, because it seems like it was a really defining song for the group. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is Diane writing about in that song?
Plastic World was kind of a response to what we were seeing going on around us, you know, especially in music, right? It's so easy to pretend, plastic world that we live in, you know, ways to God all surround us, closing in, they try to drown us, you know, so we're looking at this religion that rejects us, that, you know, Diane felt she wanted to be a part of and that I had been a part of my whole life. And once that happens, once you're rejected in that way by something that you truly believe in, it makes you very skeptical about everything else that's going on around you. And it's a wonderful skepticism because all of a sudden you can see all these things you were blind to. And, you know, we're looking at the consumerism and just the ridiculousness of what's happening and the ridiculousness of the way we're being treated simply because we've been labeled in a strange way for, you know, loving somebody. You know, it was the weirdest thing when it I have friends who figured out they were gay during that period of time, and it was horrifying for them, and they tried to put it behind them for a long time, and it just never felt wrong to me. So I could not convince myself to hide it. You know, it was just like, what is the big deal here? So I think Plastic World is a good assessment, you know, of really our philosophy at the time, which was a little out there and not what rock and roll was usually about, right? But that was us.
That was Lee Weaver discussing their work with the Indianapolis synth rock band Software. Let's pause and listen to the band's 1984 recording of Plastic World. I'm Kyle Long, and you're listening to a special Pride Month edition of Cultural Manifesto. We're celebrating the legacy of Labyrinth, a feminist lesbian bar that operated in Indianapolis from 1978 to 1984. We've been listening back to my 2021 conversation with Lee Weaver, one of the many important local and national musicians who performed at Labyrinth. Lee was also the co-founder of the Indianapolis synth rock band Software. We just heard their 1984 recording of Plastic World. Let's return to my conversation with Lee as we discuss the challenges Software faced getting their music heard in Indianapolis during the mid-1980s. Why did the band break up? Were you kind of feeling like it wasn't going to ever go anywhere? Or how did the band kind of dissolve?
I think that you can only bang your head against the wall so long, kind of thing. So we had made it into the Battle of the Bands in 1985, and that was at the Vogue. And we got there, got all set up, and the engineering was appalling. We couldn't hear each other. I mean, it just was like, did you just ask somebody to come in from the line out front? And, you know, we couldn't hear ourselves on the monitors. We actually ended up scooting the guy out of the way after our set, and Tammy and I engineered the Zero Boys, who were next, who ended up winning, okay? So there you have it, right? But, you know, guys, like, girls don't know how to do this, whatever. Okay, just, but it was horrific. And I think that was just like, you know, this is just not doing it. This is just not going to go anywhere. And takes a lot of time, and it's just disappointing continuously. We could still create music for ourselves. I mean, by that time, after Future Is Now, we invested in our own little studio, and we could do our own stuff. And that was what we were doing anyway, just with the occasional hassle of having to drag everything out of the studio to a club, you know, play for some people and drag it back, and then we're back in the studio. We could do that anyway. You know, we didn't have to keep gigging. And so what ended up happening is we worked in the studio a little bit, our own studio, which was over at Susan's house, and eventually just started, you know, Diane and I were both restaurant people. So we just kind of started working and drinking as restaurant people do, or working and partying as the case may be. And, you know, before you know, it's been a year or two, and then you go on, you know. So just kind of fell apart like that.
it sounds like there wasn't ever like a meeting where you all said, let's break up. It just, you drifted apart and it just, and the writing was on the wall eventually that this was over.
That, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, you wake up and you go, oh, I think we're not doing that anymore. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was kind of more like it.
You've used the phrase repeatedly, you felt like you were banging your head against the wall with this band. And I'm sure, you know, there were moments where it was exciting and fun.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure recording this music and capturing this unique sound was really meaningful to you.
Absolutely.
But ultimately, was that kind of the dominating kind of sense you had with this band? It's just there's too many limitations that are kind of preventing us from going anywhere and we're just banging our head against the wall.
I know for me personally, I had a different idea of what music was. I had grown up in the church where you're doing music for people for a purpose, right? And so it's hard to sustain something in a whole different atmosphere where you're, you know, on a good day, your background music for all the partying people, you know, which is great, you know. But it wasn't the same thing that I thought it was. And it was just kind of frustrating after a while that, you know, when it's my life, right? I see the world in this one way and nobody else sees it the same way. It's like, do I need another thing in my life that's really pointing that out to me, you know? So I think that's what it was for me. You know, life just started taking up more room than the band. I still listen to that music, and I love it. It still makes me happy. Often I wonder, how did I do that? Did I do that? You know, it's just shocking to me. You know, but I love it, and I know it's good. And the fact that not hardly anybody knows about it, you know, that's okay. It's good. I don't feel like, wow, I should have done better, or I should have done this here and not that. It's good music. I'm happy, and I had fun doing it. And gosh, you know, did I learn how to do that kind of music with Diana and Kara and Susan and Julie and Tammy? I mean, it was a very, very interesting ride.
View software as a closed book? Is this something that part of your life is over? This music did its work in the world and that's over? Or is this something you would like to see come back? Would you like
that's
to see
so
this music get reissued? Would you like a new generation to experience this music? And yeah, do you have any thoughts on that?
To be honest with you, I've never thought about it. Never thought about it. I've always thought, okay, that was what we did. And I've always, I suppose I would have to say, I've always hoped that there will be people who will come along who will find it relevant, that will find it and find it relevant and enjoy it, and maybe it will give them something. That would be very cool. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, in my life, I don't count on things, you know. I look and think of probabilities, you know, and is that a probability in my mind? No, if it would happen, would that be really fun and nice and gratifying? Certainly, you know, yes, it would. But I don't know. I don't know if the wind's going to blow that way. And if it doesn't, well, there it is.
Well, Lee, I can't thank you enough for taking time to share this incredible history with us today. I know I've probably kept you here longer than you expected
to be. What fun, Kyle. You just try to shut me up most of the time about this, so thank you. Thank you. I sincerely have really enjoyed talking about this and thinking about it.
Well, thank you again for being here today, Lee. It was an honor to meet you and hear about your story and the story of this group, so thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Kyle, and keep doing a great show. It's very engaging and entertaining. I appreciate it, and thanks for letting me talk.
Thank you.
We've been listening back to my 2021 interview with Lee Weaver, co-founder of the Indianapolis synth rock band Software. On this week's show, we're celebrating the legacy of Labyrus, a feminist lesbian bar that operated in Indianapolis from 1978 to 1984. That's all the time we have for this week, and we'll end with the title track from Software's 1985 cassette, The Future Is Now. You can hear my full conversations with Mary Byrne and Lee Weaver on the Cultural Manifesto podcast, available on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcasts. Cultural Manifesto is hosted and produced by me, Kyle Long. Thank you for listening. Not in control. And